Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight began selling greeting cards door to door at age 8. Built his first home at age 18, and gave the second home he ever built to his mom and dad. Since that time, his firm has built over 450,000 homes, and last year alone, built 46,000. He's raised 14 children, goes to Mass every day, and in 2005, Forbes named him the 486th richest person on the face of the earth. His name? Bill Pulte. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Bill Pulte, the founder and chairman of Pulte Homes. Bill, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your parents and your childhood?
Sure.
Fire away.
Well, I was born and raised in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I went from the first through 8 and a half grades in the middle of high school. My father got transferred to Detroit, and that's why I moved to Detroit. And I've been there ever since. I mean, metropolitan Detroit.
What'd your dad do?
He was the claims. Originally he was an automobile adjuster for the AAA insurance company, and then eventually became claims manager for all the outstate offices.
What did you learn from your mom and your dad?
Well, I think I had great parents, which a lot of people don't think they have, but I learned a lot of things. I learned that the first thing you have to do is get self-confidence, and I think my parents were really responsible for the self-confidence that I have always had since I've been a youngster. That was given to me in the way they brought us up, that they taught us whatever they were trying to teach us, whether it was like something like tying your shoes or whatever. But once you learned how to tie your shoes, you had to tie it from then on. And I don't think the parents of today have that kind of attitude. If they're in a hurry, they say, well, let me tie them for you. And my parents, once they taught you, would never do it for me or any of us children. I have five siblings. We just had to do it ourselves, and we got confident that we could do it.
What was the first jobs you ever had?
Well, the first job I really ever had was parking cars for the Michigan football stadium. We lived only about a quarter of a mile from the present stadium, and was the same stadium, except they've had a lot more seats. But so we got my younger brother, which is a year younger than I. We were about 6 years old, and we filled the cars in all the spaces we could get, the backyard, the front yard, and the driveway, and we made 25 cents a car, so it was pretty good.
At age 8, you started selling greeting cards, fresh cherries, and the Saturday Evening Post door-to-door. How did that come about?
Well, you know, it was the Depression days when I was 8 years old. It would have been 1940, and money was scarce. So I read someplace in a magazine that you could anybody could buy the greeting cards and sell them. So I was actually started out as Christmas cards. And the Christmas card went very well. I just bought so many boxes, and you went door to door until you sold them. Then in the middle of the summer, I decided I could try that with birthday cards. The demand wasn't great for birthday cards, but it still was there. So that's how I had that job. There was two cherry trees in the backyard, and my mother said for every quart of cherries I picked for her, I could have a quart that I could go door-to-door and sell. So that's how I got in the cherry-picking business.
At age 16, you become a carpenter. Why?
Well, it started when I bought my first car at the age of 16. It was a clunker car. As a matter of fact, it didn't have floorboards. I had to put floorboards in it. Otherwise, I could see the street running below me. But I went to my dad and said, no, my dad actually came to me and he says, Billy, it's nice that you got a car, but how are you going to put gas in it? And I said, well, Dad, how about giving me an allowance? And he says, how about you getting a job? So that's what got us started. And I went to the want ads of the Detroit Times at that time. And Carpenter wanted, and I went and got a job. The fellow didn't want to put me on at that time because I was 16 and I really supposed to be 18 to be in the apprentice program of the Carpenters Union. And I said, well, I'll tell you, I'll make a deal. If you let me work for a day and you don't want me, you won't have to pay me for the day. So in essence, I worked all summer. So obviously he liked what I did and I didn't have to go to the Carpenters apprentice school or anything because I told him I was going back to high school.
You're 18 years old and you build your first home. Can you tell us about that home?
Well, I have to back up to the same job as carpenter I had. I worked for a carpenter who worked for what at that time I was 16, but and the carpenter, the builder, was what I called an old Italian builder. He was probably 40. But anyway, my carpenter contractor worked for this builder. In fact, on Saturdays, because it was basically a union town for residential building back then, I worked for the builder who was a mason by trade, and his sons and brothers were a mason crew during the weekday that put in the block basements that we were building the carpentry houses on. And then he would also veneer the houses. So on Saturdays, I used to work for this builder. And the builder had a car about equal to mine. It was a clunker also. And he always pulled an old U-Haul trailer that looked like a weathered barn on the back of it. So I didn't think much of the building business at all. But then the last day, which I worked, which was the Friday before the Labor Day weekend, so it's almost exactly 56 years ago. He drove up in a brand new Cadillac with a glass of iced tea on the dashboard, and I said, I'm going to be a builder. If he can be a builder, I'm going to be one. And I never changed my direction. And so for the last 2 years of high school, I actually took correspondence courses in how to put the house together. I mean, I did learn a little bit when I was working for the carpenter how to lay out stairways, how to lay out rafters. The carpenter contractor that I was working for kind of took me on as a pseudo son. He didn't have any children. And I kept asking him questions, how do you do this and how do you do that? And he taught me quite a bit. Also on Saturdays, as I say, I worked for the mason crew. They taught me how to lay out the basement foundation, and you know, I was actually the labor throwing the gravel into the cement mixer and mixing the cement, because you didn't have ready mix show up like it does today, and then the mortar was made in the same mixer. So I learned a little bit there, and I decided that I really had to know a lot more if I wanted to build the first house. I took drafting by correspondence, and I took the only thing I didn't take, which was a mistake, was bookkeeping. But I didn't think that was too important, which was a mistake. But I was very good at math, so I could add and subtract, and I knew when I was doing something right or wrong as far as the positive and negative of the cash and so forth.
We're talking to Bill Pulte, who gave the second home he ever built to his mom and dad. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Bill Pulte, whose firm, Pulte Homes, is the second largest home builder in America. Bill, the work ethic of our suburban kids today, what are your thoughts?
Jack, before I answer that, I'd like to make a correction on the statement you made earlier. that I didn't give my parents a second house. Like, I never had that much money to give them that. But I built it at exactly cost, and I was the first one to convince them that they could own their own house. They'd never owned their own house before. But I convinced them that they could get a mortgage of whatever the amount was in those days, and that they could afford it. I'll go to your question.
You correct me on the golf course, too. I tell you I get a four, you say, no, that was a five, Jack. So, the work ethic of our kids today, what are your thoughts?
Well, I was brought up in a Depression era, and work was a very valuable asset. Anybody had a job really was fortunate. That was one thing about my father. He always had a job, even though it was a very low-paying job, all through the Depression. But today, the most important thing is not work to kids, it's how much they can play. And they would much rather have free time to play than they would have time to work, at least the majority of them. And that's because of the good times, I think, we live in. And really, work is not of any importance to a lot of them.
You had 9 children with your first wife. Then you marry a second wife. She has 5 already. You bring those 2 families together, and they age from age 6 to 17, 14 children. 2 questions. How big was the house, and what did you learn from that experience?
Well, we built a special house because we had 13 bedrooms and 10 baths, and mostly all but the youngest 2 girls and the youngest 2 boys had their own bedroom, and they all shared a bath. That's the size of the house. What I learned is patience.
So, let's go to Pulte Homes. Every company has a culture. What is the culture of Pulte Homes, and how do you propagate that culture?
Well, I would like to say that the culture of Pulte is a big family. There's nobody that's the ruler, godfather, boss in any way, shape, or form. Everybody is equal. Everybody has the right to come to my office anytime they want. They can say any idea they have, and we'll see if it makes sense. We've gotten a lot of good ideas from just people saying, what happens if we change this or change that or did this? And everybody, no matter whether it's a telephone operator or secretaries or the chief executive always calls me Bill. Everybody calls everybody by their first name. There is no Mr. Pulte or Mr. Duga or whatever. It's all Bill on first name basis. And, of course, you got to live by the same standards that you want your family to live. And so that's the basic way, is they follow your example. If you give good example, you will get that.
You feel very strongly that every employee's priority should be, number one, God, number two, their family, and then number three, Pulte Homes. Why?
Well, I think that that's a true way to go through life. Too many people put so much emphasis on their job. Somebody who works 16 hours a day, we don't want them working at Pulte. Workaholics, we don't want them working at Pulte because they're not really rounded like we want to have them in our employment. We've had people brag about how often they work and how many hours a week they work. That means they're leaving either their God or their family or both to a secondary position, and that's the wrong way to go through life, in my opinion.
Business Week recently said that Bill Pulte's contribution to the Fortune 500 is that he's running a modern business by age-old values. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Bill Pulte, who believes that you lead people and you manage things. Bill, in your core values, you say some things. We maintain financial discipline and will return honest profits. We treat our people as our most important asset because they are. We reward people based on merit, not entitlement. Customer delight is our standard and will not be sacrificed. And the last one, humility is expected. These are non-negotiable. How can you be successful and humble at the same time in today's business world?
Well, I think it's very easy. In fact, I think it's much more easier to succeed, much more easier, forget my English, but it's easier to succeed by being humble than it is to be egotistic. I think you get a lot more things done, for example, if you don't have to take credit for everything. So many leaders think they have to take credit for everything. If you can show them that they were a part of it, or pat them on the back as being part of it, or even the instigator of it, they'll do it again. But if you tear them apart, and there are some people in the automobile industry that have torn their people apart, and they took credit for everything, and they didn't deserve it, you'll get more done. So it's easy to do it by humility.
In your opinion, what makes a great leader?
Well, I think a good leader or a great leader has to have vision. That's one of the most important things. He has to see far out and wide, not very narrow. That's not a good leader. He has to see a long ways out, and the horizon has to be 180 degrees wide. Next, he's got to have, from that, he's got to be able to build a long-term strategy. How do you use that to your advantage and have some strategy how you're going to get where you want to go? Then he's got to give responsibility to others. You can't do anything all by yourself. I firmly believe there's no such thing as a self-made man. Nobody does it by themselves. A small group doesn't do it. The whole team does it. When the Pistons won in L.A. a few years ago, there was two superstars on L.A.'s team, but we had a full family team, if you will. No real superstars. We had some good players. But we won because we did it as a team. And I think that you got to delegate responsibility and then reward those people who do it. And they will do the same to others. And that's how I've grown as big as I have, because I let people do the job, rewarded them for it, and they let other people do the job, and they got rewarded. Next, you got to establish the right values and have people coached on what it really means to have those values. It can't be just conversation. I mean, we've had some difficulty with sexual harassment, and we've had to let good people go because we can't be thought of as somebody who's going to let sexual harassment take place in our company. So we've had to let some very good people go because of things like that. A good leader asks what and why. What do you want to do and why do you want to do it, or what do we want to go, or what direction do we want to go and why? And then he does the right things. You lead people and you manage things, and leadership is all about leading people in the right direction.
We're talking to Bill Pulte, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Bill Pulte, who's raised 14 children. Bill, in business today, the only constant is change. Give us your thoughts on change.
Well, first of all, I love change. Change is exciting to go further and go further and further in any business, and to grow, you have to change. How would you like to be in the electronic business today and decide you don't want change? 10 months you'd be out of business. You wouldn't quite be out of the business in the building business, but in a couple of years, if you didn't take change, you would be out of business. When you look back when I started 1950 in business, we still do a lot of things the same way. The 2x4 puts the house together, but we didn't have kitchen cabinets. They were all built on the job. We didn't have pre-hung doors. They were all built on the job. We didn't have windows that came to the job with glass in them. They didn't have insulated glass. If you put all these things together, they're very subtle changes over 50-some years, but they are big changes. And if you're still in the glass business or the window business and delivering glass, not in the window even anymore, you wouldn't be existing. If you were still trying to hang doors the old-fashioned way, you couldn't be in business. So change is very important. Another thing I'd like to say that people often ask me, why do you think you've been as successful as you have? And I say there's five reasons why I've been so successful, I believe. One is I've always had a plan. In other words, I always had a direction I wanted to go in. Number two is I've had geographic and product diversification, which are very important. If you're just doing a one-way street everything, you won't have anywhere near the opportunity if something shuts down. I can remember in the early 80s when we were building 750 houses here a year in Detroit in the early, like 1980, and we were building 250 in Denver. But 1983, we built 3,000 houses in Denver, and we were in the Rust Belt recession here, and we had only 75 houses that we built in Detroit. So again, geographic product and diversification is very important. The next is I was never afraid to take a calculated risk. You can never be first place if you don't take risk. I mean, if you wait for somebody else to show you the way, you'll never win, all right? You'll never be in first place. And another thing is I was never afraid to make changes. I can tell you, all through my life, I've had to make changes. And in some cases, actually, the whole city has changed because of what we did. First time I went to Washington, D.C., for example, they were building block basements. And everybody thought block basements. By the way, we were building block basements when I first went into business here. But in the early 60s, the mid-60s, we went all to poured wall basements. They're faster, they're better, and they're stronger. So we introduced block basements in Washington, D.C. I remember the first time I was there, I walked my finance man through the house, and he gave me, he says, well, they look nice, Bill, but there was 10 reasons they wouldn't sell. And here I had all my money that I could beg, borrow, and steal invested in this big subdivision. And he started to reel these off. In 3 years, every builder in the neighborhood, which was the metropolitan, that side of Washington, D.C., was doing 9 of the things I was doing because they were faster, better, and stronger. But they had never been introduced. So you got to be able to do change. Without changes, it just don't work.
There's a dictum that a lot of people follow.
By the way, I want to do one thing, Jack. The last thing that's most important is good people. If you don't have good people, that's the most important. And the ability to select good people is the most important thing of a people's skills.
Hiring the best. Okay, right. We all believe that. What do you say to people that say, Bill, I'm starting out, I can't afford to hire the best person?
Well, you got to hire the best. Now, there's a couple ways of doing that, and one of the ways I use quite successfully is I took the younger of the best, okay? Meaning I didn't go to a 45 or 50-year-old old-timer who was well trained in the business. I took risk with some new young guy at 25, but he turned out to be the best. So sometimes you have to take risk, but you hire persons much better than you for whatever you want them to do.
What do you say to someone who says, I'm afraid to hire someone who's smarter than I?
Dumbest thing you could do is not hire people smarter than you. Nobody's going to be smarter than you in everything. I could tell you a quick story. I went to Wall Street when I was just after I'd gone public. And it was a round table of all the builders that were public in those in that day, which were like 1970. And they asked the questions on the finance side of the building business. And the questions were going right over my head. I had my advisor, my finance guy with me. They were going over his heads. All the other guys knew the answer. But then they started to go to the trade, and I never saw so much double talk in all my life. And I was the only one in the room who knew it was double talk because they didn't have the slightest idea about the trade side of the business. And they weren't, in many cases, two or three of them are bankrupt now, but they were not smart enough to go try the trade side. On the way home, I said, geez, I'm in the major leagues. I better find a finance guy that really knows what he's doing, which is what I did. And from then on, I never hired anybody that wasn't better than me in the position I wanted them.
If I'm starting out in business, how do I convince the best young people to come with me?
Well, the trick I used, and again, in those days it was pretty good, we paid rather low salaries, but we paid awful high bonuses. I mean, we had kids that were, kids, I was one of them, by the way, but we had people 20 and 25 years old that maybe we were paying them 100 grand, but they made a $1 million bonus. And it was, if they could see something like that and know what was happening, it's not too hard to hire good people if they don't want security. The last question I ever asked anybody in those days was, what retirement plan you wanted? If they were worried about a retirement plan, they weren't ready to work for me at that time because we were young and going.
What do you say to someone who says, Bill, I can't afford to do things classy until I get more successful?
Well, I think that's a false thought because you got to do them classy to be successful. Now, you don't have to always spend the same amount of money, but you got to do it classy. For example, if you're decorating a model, for example, you could put in furniture that is very expensive, depending on the buyer that you're after. But on the other hand, you could get an interior designer who can get used furniture and put it in and do a great job for you. I mean, there's ways that you can do it first class, but don't have to spend first class money. And I learned that a long time ago.
You're 74 years old.
No, 49, okay. Jack.
You're a billionaire. Yet you still go to work every day. Why? And what do you do?
Well, first of all, I never have gone to work a day in my life. I've enjoyed the business I've been in so much that it's never been work. There's been some tough days, but it's never really been work. When I'm losing to you on the golf course, it's tough times, but it ain't work. But so I never have really gone to work at all in my life, and I still enjoy the building business as much as anything else. People say, why don't you, you know, play more golf and work? I have more fun working than I do playing golf, especially the way my handicap's going. But that's why I keep working. What was the next question you asked me?
Well, we did play a few weeks ago, and you lost $2 to me.
I know, and I still owe it to
you were madder at losing the $2 than you were in losing hundreds of millions in stock market. Why?
Well, I can't get the $2 back from you, but in the stock market, I think I can get it back.
All right, let's talk about outsourcing and the whole Mexican immigration issue. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a big problem. There's no question about it, and there's the far right and the far left. But we got what they say is 12 million people in this country, and those 12 million people are really the backbone of some industries. They're the backbone of the hotel industry. They're the backbone of many areas of the farming industry. They certainly are the backbone of the tradesmen in this country. The Mexican people are uneducated, but once you train them how to do something in our business, they do it right and correct every time. They try to, because when you're supporting a family, you want to make sure you keep that job, and they do value working. Whereas you said earlier, you know, our young people really don't have value. They want to play, but they're not willing to work like the people from Mexico. So somehow we got to find a way in which we can have these people stay here legally because they do a great service for America.
We're talking to Bill Pulte, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News 1060 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Bill Pulte. Bill, in the winter, you and Karen like to go to Naples, and on Sunday night you fly back from Fort Myers, and you sit in coach. You're wealthy enough to buy not the plane, the whole airline. Why do you sit in coach?
It gets you there as quick as first class, maybe three seats earlier, but or three seats later, but it gets you there. Why pay the extra money?
So, most every day you go to Mass. Why?
Well, I think it's the right way to start a day. If you go to Mass, well, first of all, I think the reason I go to Mass is I firmly believe that Christ's message, I have the gift of faith in that Christ's message is that you want to love and forgive. And that's reminded every day in a Mass, either through the readings or actually the consecration, that we don't want to let our ego get a hold of us. It isn't going to get us where you want to be. So it's just the right way to start peacefully the day.
You've stated that your philosophy of life is, quote, the measure of one's true success is their internal peace. Can you talk about that?
Well, I don't think that being powerful or wealthy will ever give you inner peace. And I'm not a doctor or anything, but more and more people are finding out that they have inner peace. They don't have the tension. They don't have the anxieties and so forth. I don't let things bother me. In fact, a lot of people say, why don't they bother you? Well, because why let them bother you if they're not? If you can't do anything about them, first of all, you don't want to worry about them. That's what a lot of people do. They worry about many things they can't do anything about. And to be able to filter those out quick is a great asset. But inner peace will give you much more wealth and better inner feeling and feeling of accomplishment than anything else in my book. Power and money aren't going to give you.
For a lot of people, they find it extremely hard to trust God and to surrender to His will. How have you learned to do that?
Well, you just have to do it one time and find out it works. For example, often I've prayed over a lot of times in my life for something, and either it didn't come on time or it didn't come the way I thought. But in the end, what I prayed for wasn't exactly what I was praying for, but the end results that I did have was much greater than I was praying for. Or it wasn't in a timely way that I wanted, but again, the timing turned out to be better than I ever thought it would have been. So you just have to learn to trust no matter. We trust everybody to trust some people. We drive down the street, we're trusting that the driver next to us is not going to crash into us and so forth. We're always trusting everybody to do certain things. But if you have lucky enough to have the faith in God and trust God, it works.
Michigan is in a major transformation. In your opinion, what has to change for us to really be vibrant again?
Well, some of the laws in the state of Michigan have to change. One of them, for example, the small business tax is going to be done away with. But the environment is not good here in Michigan at all, especially for the manufacturing. And even for the home building business, it's not good. Example, when I first started in Michigan to be in the land development business, that's build subdivisions in which we build houses on now, it would take 4 to 5 months maximum to take a farmer's field into a piece of property that you could take and build houses on. Today, that probably takes a good 2 years. In Texas, I can still do it in 5 to 9 months. In Phoenix and Vegas, I can still do it in 5 to 9 months. Why? Well, we don't have all of the political fighting and all of the make work jobs that the state and the governmental agencies seem to have. So I think we've got to change some rules. So when you go to Texas, they say, come on in, how can we help you? When you come to Michigan, they pretend to say that, but they say, well, we got this law that says you can't do this, and you got this law that says you can't do that. These laws have to be changed.
Through the years, right now you've got 12,500 employees, 46,000 homes. You must get sued 8 times a day, yet you don't have a bitterness. There's not a hatred about you. Why not?
Well, first of all, we don't get sued that many times. Okay. But secondly, what's the point of getting upset about it? You thought you did the job right, and if we can't settle it and we have to go to court to settle it, which we hope we don't have to do very often, but we try to settle it without. And oftentimes the customer might be right, and if it's right, we'll go fix it or do something, whatever it's required. But a lot of times they're not, and they just want to be aggravating, and they think by being aggravating they can get something that they shouldn't get. And on those cases, we will take them all away because we don't want that attitude to spread anyplace.
What role has faith played in your life?
Well, faith in God, I kind of expressed that earlier, but I firmly believe that Jesus gave the right message, that we got to love and forgive. And the people that carry hate is something I don't understand at all. They carry it through and they want always to see the death penalty and all this. That isn't going to make them happy when it's all over. So hate is not it's a bad thing to have around.
What dreams or goals do you still have?
Well, the main thing that I would like to have is a company that when I'm gone carries on and becomes even a much larger company than it is today, by far maybe the largest company in the United States, and by far maybe in even the world of building houses. But companies have failed and fallen apart once the founder and leader is gone, that they disappear in a short time. And I have too many people that their whole family life is based on the success of Pulte, and I don't want to see that go away.
1 minute left. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Well, I think that you have to take the attitude, first of all, that you got to work hard. You know, everybody's trying to win the lotto and then put down a few dollars and become millionaires, but they all hate millionaires, but they all want to be one. But work hard and don't give up because you failed the first time. Just keep plugging and trust in God, and you'll get there.
Bill, I want to say thanks for coming on. Thanks for what you do for thousands of people all over the world and the way in which you do it.
Thanks, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday night. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spong.